Bristol, For the Record, a new local oral history podcast from BCFM Radio in partnership with MShed Bristol and funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund.
There was a time when the Bible of what's on in Bristol and Bath was Venue Magazine. Founded in 1982, it quickly gained a reputation for the quality and authority of its coverage, being one of the early champions of the Bristol sound and operating one of the longest-running commercial websites in the country, until its closure 20 years later in 2012. Dougal Templeton was one of its founders, and since then, he has gone on to be involved in a number of media, tech and food ventures in Bristol and beyond. To kick things off, Dougal, why is local media so important?
I think there's a lot of sound reasons behind that, which is that local media can fragment from away from the kind of corporate national chains that own local media or tend to own local media now, with their vested interests and the kind of stuff that they kind of miss out, I think. And local media tends to be more narrow and deep on certain niche topics. So I think you get an incredible array of knowledge from people locally about their given areas, whether that be music, clubs, and things like the Cable, who are an alternative to a traditional evening paper.
How would you describe the current health and state of local media in Bristol at the moment?
Very mixed, I think. I think there are amazing projects and things going down on the ground. Strangely, my background is as a trained journalist who worked in regional evening papers, local media, in the old sense, traditional sense of that, and I think they're not in great health. And I think there were always places for things like the Evening Post. But I think that's reducing and getting carved up into multiple kind of operations that are very specialist. So I don't think they're in great health. But that said, there are also amazing projects going on, like BCFM. You know, there are some fantastic projects that really fill me. I get really excited by them. And I think there is, obviously, with technology, the advance of technology, it makes it much more accessible to people to just get up and do some stuff that maybe back in my day, back in the old days, there was a real entry, a barrier to entry around cost, setting up a magazine or setting up a radio station. Whereas now technology means that it's open to a lot more people.
So you touched upon it there, starting off as a journalist. How did you get into media? Can you describe your journey?
I couldn't do anything else. So I left school, wanted to go to uni, and then thought, actually, I don't want to go to uni. I want to just get out there and do something. And I'm a good writer. I'm a good people person. And someone said to me, oh, you need to think about journalism. And I kind of in a very strange sliding door. I've had a lot of sliding door moments in my life. And one of them was working on the desk at The Guardian, opening letters and going out and buying sandwiches for kind of great journalists. And I stumbled upon a story that made the front page. And kind of the editor walked into the massive newsroom and said, so who's this guy Dougal Templeton? Who's that? And everyone looked at each other, shrugged and went, no idea. And I kind of stuck my hand up. And through that, he got me into National Council Training in Journalism. So I did a year's course and never looked back.
What was the story you found?
I used to have to, as part of my job, I used to have to go out and buy publications for specialist journalists and go and run errands and pick up, do a bit of research. And my brother was at the LSE and he told me that there was a guy called, from memory, Professor Isink, who had this whole thing about that people were racially, mentally inferior, and the black community. And it was massively controversial. And he was giving a talk at the LSE and I went along to abuse him and was beaten to it by a load of people that stormed the stage and kicked the shit out of him. And it was a big, and I sort of ran the news desk. Would this be constitute a good story? This guy's, whatever you do, just go and get a quote from whoever, So I kind of stumbled into it. But it made the front page and was an exclusive for The Guardian, so.
And does that lead on to Venue Magazine?
Yeah. I used to work at the Bath Chronicle and kind of went up to work at the BBC, but had kind of fallen in love with the West Country and a woman, as you do, in love of a good woman, and came back to Bath pulling nails out of planks in a reclamation yard and thought I'd set up an arts magazine, really. It was a bit kind of artsy-fartsy, trendy, kind of, that's what I had in mind. Was out in the street, bumped into a person I hadn't met for years, was walking down the street with him, chatting. He then bumped into a friend he hadn't seen for years. They were chatting in the street, and he said, well, what are you up to? And this guy said, oh, I'm thinking of setting up a magazine, but I don't know anything about journalism. I'm looking for an editor. And I went, I'm your man. And kind of between us, we set up what was called Out West originally, based on kind of Time Out. Him and I, it turned out this guy was utterly useless. I mean, he was just in it to make as much money as he possibly could, which is fair enough, you know, it's an investment. But he didn't really care about journalism, and I had particular views. So I left and set up my own magazine with a whole bunch of other people that then became Venue. So, yeah, literally, you know, seize the moment. You kind of, when you see an opportunity, seize it. Kind of always talk to my kids about this. You know, sometimes in life you're presented with something and you, yeah. Chance, choice, change, I call it. You've got to take a chance, need to make a choice to make a change.
So the early days of Venue Magazine, where were you located? Who were you working with? How did it feel?
It was funny because actually, whilst I knew a lot about journalism and had very clear ideas, well, clear ideas, borrowed, begged, stolen from mainly Time Out at the time, which was the kind of big daddy of that sort of, you know, agitprop, stroke, what's on, mix. I didn't really understand about business or, you know, how to set up stuff. It was like we made it up as we went along. Our first edition was done in somebody's bedroom. We then moved this thing called The Watershed, was opening at the time, and they let us work overnight in their booking office and let us use that as an office. And we literally would go in there at half 10, 11 at night, work all through the night and come out. And then kind of got a foothold and moved to Jamaica Street, where the Jamaica Street studios are in Stokes Croft, an amazing building, stunning building. And that sort of became our spiritual home.
And how did those early days feel?
Oh, man. Like hard work. It was, I mean, again, technology. Most of the people listening to this, I really, really wish I'd kept the kind of letter set and paste up boards and typesetting. You know, so you used to have to cut and paste all this stuff onto boards, then take it to the printers who would kind of take images from it. And then they'd print from that, you know, and it was literally done with letter set and stuff called typesetting where you paste it onto a board. And it was just such a pain to kind of, it was so laborious. And so that's how we kind of started. We'd work 6 days a week, 20 hours a day. No money, very little money, you know, not paying ourselves anything. Normal startup, kind of all done with passion and sandwiches and a lot of other, means of getting through. So it was an adventure. It was amazing, but really grueling. And then as we kind of got older with it and kind of got into it, people were getting a bit older. They suddenly wanted to rent flats or buy a house or had kids. So we're thinking, oh, Christ, we really need to think about the financials behind this. It wasn't sustainable just doing it on blood, sweat and tears. So I kind of became more entrepreneurial. It's funny because when you set it up as a journalist, it's like a kid in a sweet shop. No one is going to tell you what you can and can't write, which is traditionally what sub-editors or an editor. No, you can't do that story. Why not? Well, actually, I'll do whatever story I want. It's my magazine. So very self-indulgent, very ill-disciplined, but actually the irony of it being that I became less of a journalist and more of a business manager, make sure there's enough toilet paper, and kind of it was, I got pushed in sideways, but retained because of my love of writing and eating a lot, I kind of insisted that I remain food editor. So I kind of specialised around restaurants and pubs, a lot of drinking.
When did you realise that you were onto a winner and things became more sustainable?
That's an interesting question, because we were pretty politically, you know, we obviously had an agenda, a tone of voice and a mission about what we were doing, and we were definitely punching way above our weight in terms of influence in the city. So even though our, you know, I don't know, Evening Post had a circulation back then of call it 120,000, ours was 8,000. But somehow we had a presence and a meaning, and I think suddenly people who previously closed doors to us and refused to talk to us suddenly began talking to us. The council, which was very old-fashioned back then and kind of stuck in its ways and very regressive, suddenly started listening to stuff that we were campaigning about. And also, interestingly, back then, the whole notion about paid for and unpaid for kind of, you know, this is a key thing around journalism, is what, you know, paywalls and what do you pay for? Well, back then it was a magazine you sold in the newsagents, so there was cover price on it. So people were committed, and our sales just went up and up and up and up. So suddenly we thought, hell, this is having an impact.
You said earlier you had a mission, you had a way of writing. What is that, or what was that?
I don't think we ever formalised it into a kind of mission statement. We weren't that kind of savvy. It was just born out of our own individual... And again, like I said before, there were role models out there, The Guardian, whatever. So our mission was to entertain and to inform and to make a difference in the local community. You know, that's where we knew we were getting to be a bigger fish, but in a small pool. But that didn't matter. We were really doing good stuff. You know, the crude thing, I don't know whether you want to edit this, was to do good shit. And that's kind of where we go. I don't know what, no one could define what doing good shit meant, but I mean, we knew it when we'd done it.
So as well as doing What's On listings of the arts and entertainment scene in Bristol and Bath, you also did do journalism, didn't you, in campaigns?
Yeah, so that more reflected my, you know, at the time, I mean, there was probably a founding group of about six or seven of us, but I was the only formally trained journalist. And there's a lot of amazing journalists that have joined us and cut their teeth at Venue and gone on. But we definitely, whilst the entertainment and the listings were the core honeypot that attracted people, we kind of still wanted to do some big pieces, investigating the merchant venturers about their position in the city, or Freemasonry in the police force, or racial bias in, you know, the kind of all the sort of no dogs, no Irish, no blacks, you know, was shockingly prevalent in Bristol back then. So we definitely, we had an agenda to do some investigative stuff. Actually, we were very proudly sued in my first issue by the Duke of Beaufort, which is one of my wonderful claims to fame, is that we wrote about saboteur hunting. We were very anti-hunting, and we wrote this whole piece about how the Duke of Beaufort's guys used to go around beating the shit out of anti-hunt sabs. But we didn't have the proof. And of course, if he's listening. Actually, he was very funny about it. I quite admired it, because he threatened to sue us. And we said, go ahead, we haven't got anything. And he was going to put us out of business. And he relented and agreed for us to pay a contribution to the Duke of Beaufort hunting ball, which he knew would stick in our throat. And then sent us 4 free tickets to come along. So we had to contribute to the hunt ball, which I thought was quite neat.
Did you go?
Do you know what? I've thought so long and hard about that. I thought this could be very funny. I'll write a colour piece, you know, but I didn't in the end. I thought, actually, no, I'm not going to do that.
So you just said that's one of your proudest moments. Can you think of any other moments that jump out at you over the years of running Venue?
I was trivialising that, but... Do you know what, Marcus? There was a whole raft of stuff from very low-key but actually significant. So if someone had written a play and worked 2 years on writing this masterpiece, and they'd got a village hall or a kind of little centre somewhere to put the play on, we would give real due attention to that, maybe rather than the one on at the Old Vic, or Hippodrome. And we really kind of focused on supporting emerging talent. So instead of an audience of maybe 10 people turn up, they'd sell it out, you know, 2-3 nights over. So on that level, it was really gratifying. And then there were some various campaigns that we ran that were really successful. I think one of the things we did, rather than just reporting on the community and reflecting back, we wanted to be an active part in changing the community ourselves off the back of what we did. And so there was an amazing, iconic festival called the Ashton Court Festival, which was a free festival held in, funnily enough, Ashton Court, which was an amazing thing put on particularly by this one guy, Mark, and it struggled each year, and then they gave up. So Venue stepped in, funded it with what little few pence we had, and became part of the organising committee and got it back going up again for 3-4 years, and then it grew from there into quite a massive and highly respected event in the calendar, in the Bristol calendar. But I'd like to think we played a real big part in saving that. So there were things, yeah, it wasn't just about the investigative pieces that we ran, or, you know, we'd campaign for housing, we'd campaign for arts groups, Spike Island, you know, Spike Island, which is probably one of the premier artistic centres in Europe. Well, they were in an old ruined warehouse down in the docks that's since been knocked down, and the council just viewed them as a real pain and were trying to evict them and stop them, and we kind of say, hang on, this is insane. You know, this is the outside of Amsterdam. This is the biggest collection of artists in Europe. Why are you trying to close them down? Don't close them down. Find them a new home. So we ran a whole campaign that, not just on our own, with people. I don't want to claim full credit for Spike Island, but we were a major part of it.
And also the Bristol Sound, one of the early champions.
I mean, that was another thing I personally was really proud of, is that you would get young kids come off the street and go, oh, I want to be a journalist, I want to write music, I want to write film. And we'd kind of say, well, here's a biro or a quill, go and write something. And then we'd kind of get them to go out and do reviews. As journalists, we would then feed back about their writing styles and encourage and build them. And a lot of these people really latched on, you know, no credit to me, but to Venue, was the whole backing for the Bristol Sound was huge from us. And also, I don't know, dull stuff. Like, we used to buy sponsor paints for 3D, Banksy. You know, back in the day when they were really struggling, we used to fight the police about these guys are vandals. You know, we used to campaign for them and pay for a lot of the materials. So, yeah, some good stuff.
Sounds amazing. Some real proud moments there.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, it mustn't have been all plain sailing. What were some of the lows and challenges over the years?
Wow. Yeah, a lot of lows. We went bust at one point and had to reinvest money. I think there was always, we were always kind of a step away from penury, you know, and trying to pay contributors and trying to pay and create proper wage structures. For me, we kind of, that stress level was always slightly playing in the background. I don't know, low points, I guess we'd get things wrong occasionally and end up in kind of legal situations that maybe we shouldn't have, that threatened the whole thing.
Do you have any examples?
One really silly one was I wrote a food review of a certain establishment, tapas establishment in the centre that had just opened, and was comparing it to an independent tapas outlet on White Ladies Road, and wrote some pretty heavy duty stuff about how the chicken tasted like the chicken had walked all the way from Spain. And, you know, the eggs were about as tasty as the cardboard they arrived in. And it was pretty over the top. And then they, because they were a massive chain, they went legal on it. So suddenly I'm sitting there kind of facing the closure of the magazine or paying money that we didn't have. Or we were critical of some of the free festivals back in when the free festivals all kicked off, Summer of Love. There were some really good ones and there were some real outrageously bad ones that just took advantage, were rip-offs basically, and we called it out as such, and I got involved in a lot of threats, personal threats, serious personal threats. That was pretty interesting.
It sounds it. So I'm looking here, over the years, Venue Magazine has been released fortnightly, sometimes weekly, sometimes monthly.
Yeah.
How did it start? What happened? Where did it end up?
We started fortnightly. We had a sister publication that was a bit more posho sort of lifestyle magazine that was monthly called Folio. And we went from fortnightly. People always got a bit confused which week of the cycle the magazine came out. So we felt there was enough going on to go weekly, which was a massive step for us. I mean, you know, it was a whole change of gear. But it worked. That was fine. So I don't know, after about 10 years of being fortnightly, we went weekly and remained so, yeah.
And was it successful? Was it a good move, do you feel?
Ooh, good question. Got mixed feelings about that. I think it diluted the audience slightly. So collectively over two issues, we sold more copies than one fortnightly issue. But of course, there are a lot of attendant costs in producing that extra issue. So net, I don't think it benefited us particularly. And it created a lot of stress for the people working there. We had to produce twice the amount of content, clearly.
And over the years, you've had a number of quite well-known writers and journalists, including the stand-up comedian Mark Watson, yeah. Scriptwriter Stephen Merchant, journalist Kim Newman as well.
Also, I don't know whether you will remember a recent tragic story about Don Phillips, who was the guy who was investigating the Amazon, the corruption in the Amazon and the destruction of the rainforest, and was murdered. He was a stalwart of Venue and started as clubs editor, actually on their own publication, then joined Venue and then went on to edit Mixmag.
Oh, wow.
Was his background, and then went on to become a highly respected international journalist. Stephen Merchant was funny. He came along to us for a kind of this tall guy, wandered into the office, and we used to love taking on people who we thought might have some talent. He had none. No, he
didn't. I'm sure he'd love that.
He didn't, though. He was he was very quiet and diffident, but a very good writer, and he had great ideas. And then kind of came out and said, oh, I'm really sorry. You know, after about a year with us, I think he then left to join one of the London radio stations, which is, and working with Rick Gervais. So, yeah, we made him. He owes us. Actually, I think I still owe him money.
Is there anyone else you could think of over the years that have gone through the ranks at Venue Magazine?
God, you should ask me. I'm too old to remember. What would quite often happen, there was a guy, Phil, and I'm ridiculously, embarrassingly, can't remember his surname, but a lot of people would say, write specialist stuff for us, like jazz. I'm thinking of Phil, who then went on to write for National Stuff and then became a really highly regarded jazz writer across lots of national papers.
Amazing. In the introduction, I mentioned that Venue Magazine had the longest-running commercial website. Is that right?
I mean, this is way back in the day at the advent of, you know, it was really funny. One of the guys who was a journalist there, well, Eugene, who you've met, an interview, came in and said, Dougal, there's these things called computers. They're amazing, you know, an Amstrad. You know, we should really get involved with computers. It will make our life so much easier. And that's kind of how it started. And then someone came along and said, oh, there's this thing called the web internet, you know. And I became fascinated. I'm blowing bigging up myself, but I kind of knew, you just know straight away that that is the future and that there is going to be this sort of decline of print and paper, which was kind of, even back then seemed very antiquated. So I was fascinated about how publishers would manage to have both the print product, which is what earned them their crust, whilst introducing a web version that didn't then take away from the print revenue. And so we set one up very early doors with an amazingly talented group of guys from Bristol who actually now own, I think, the second biggest independent digital agency in UK, great state. And we had these really dinky little first versions of websites that ran alongside what we did. And part of my departure from Venue was that we just never had that. I felt it needed serious investment to get the whole web part of it taking over from the print and to create something online that would kind of take over from Venue, the print, you know, which was on a downward cycle, really.
And then looking here, the Venue magazine was then sold to the Bristol Evening Post. So when did that happen and how did that come about?
That was a very painful process for me personally as the founder of Venue, but I kind of felt that I'd gone as far as I think I was there, 20-something years, 24 years. I had other ambitions outside of just doing the magazine, although we had a small group of regional publications by then, not just Venue. And I just felt I'd personally had gone as far as I could with it, but also financially we were in a bit of a rut. We weren't throwing off enough profit to reinvest heavily back into the product. And the Evening Post at the time was an independent local publishing. I mean, ironically, they were our arch enemy, and we used to have this kind of, some of it banter, but some of it true. You know, we were sort of on opposite sides. But they, you know, I was very friendly with their then editor, and he persuaded me they totally respected our independence, wouldn't move us into their building, would allow all the editorial decisions to be made, and wanted to invest hundreds and hundreds of thousands into online. Very little of which transpired. So I kind of left. They took it on and I think it just withered, really. They didn't love it. In fact, I think it was sacrificed. Personally, I think it was sacrificed. And this is when you go back to your question, Marcus, about local media. You know, they were in trouble themselves. They had to think about stuff. And they had a weekend supplement that was a what's on thing, and yet they're also doing Venue, and I think they wanted to fold the Venue content into the Evening Post so that they could big up their sales, because as the sales dropped, so did their revenue, advertising revenue. So they tried to kind of switch it over, and in the process cocked it up, I think, and just closed it.
How did you feel when Venue magazine was no more?
In terms of the actual product, I felt it had run its course and that this was a whole new world, a digital world that we were living in, and there were bigger and better things to be done. On a personal level, I felt incredibly sad because there were a lot of old-timers who had been there from the early days who were still earning a living from it, and that made me really sad. So it was very mixed emotions, really.
And then there was an article that BuzzFeed picked up and it went viral.
What was that?
Go on, From the research here, it's saying a number of the writers that were still there, a number of the staff members wrote something.
Oh, God, yeah.
And then it went viral.
Unbelievable. One of them bravely kind of penned this whole thing in the own publication as it was shutting and slipped it through the net that just steamed into the Evening Post. It was genius, and it was so beautifully written as well. And basically trashed the whole kind of notion of what the Post was about and what Venue had been about, and which made us all laugh.
Sounds hilarious. So since the days of Venue magazine, what have you been up to, Dougal? What have been your new ventures? You've been a busy man.
I was really fascinated in digital. And back then, the whole dot-com boom was happening, and there were just all these weird and wonderful things going, taking off, getting obscene amounts of investment behind them. And myself and the guys that I was talking about, who had done our first ever site, had 10 great ideas that were going to change the world for and we were going to go out and get loads of money. And one of them was about people getting back in touch with each other after school. That then, you know, went on for, as Friends Reunited. But we had a load of ideas geared up for that, got a load of really incredible, talented young kids together. And then the whole dot-com collapsed. So they kind of changed tactic and went on to become a sort of digital service agency, which wasn't my bag, really. I was more interested in digital publishing. So I had a few titles left over. Bizarrely, Irish Dancing magazine, long story.
Niche.
But slightly niche, which was run from a sort of kitchen table in Bristol and set up in Bristol and became a worldwide thing. And I wanted to do that online with these people that had set that up. And I had an animation magazine from our days working with Aardman. There's an amazing, I don't know whether you ever knew this, about the Aardman piece that was based on...
No.
So early days, I lived next door to this guy who was doing Morph at the time and a talented animator. And he said, oh, we've set up this new animation company and we're going to do these conversation pieces. And we want to come in and tape a day of life at venue. And then we're going to do a little animation around the characters and the voices. And they did a series of about six, I think, conversation pieces. Look at, people should go and check it out. It is hilarious because it will give you a real flavour of what venue was about. And so that was the early days of Aardman, and we became very close with them. So I was really interested in taking print titles, as I said before, and seeing how it worked online. So I developed a whole, I kind of played like a mad professor in the corner of the kitchen with these small titles, trying to work out how that would pan out online, and kind of eventually got there. So set up a company doing digital publications. Off the back of that, I then got involved with a print thing that back in the day that was a really good charity fundraising book called The Invitation Book. Yeah, The Invitation Book, which was basically a book that you put lots of discounts from local... and then charities would, or group young scouts, whoever, would sell it to supporters for 10 quid, say, but they'd have 50 quid's worth of discounts in there that they'd use. And again, it was a print product, and I thought, this is ridiculous. And funny enough, my son said, this is a brilliant idea. He was about 20 and at college doing digital media. Fantastic idea, but who carries around a bloody great book the size of a, you know, catalogue, Yellow Pages catalogue in their pocket? You need it to be digital. And, wow, how? And he said, well, actually, they're doing all this stuff in Korea with mobile phones. So this was pre-anything, you know. So we actually created this mobile discount on Nokia phones. And then this thing came out called an iPhone. And everyone went, holy shit, wow, this is a game changer. And it's amazing to be there at, you know, at that moment in time of technology as a publisher. Anyway, long story short, that became a thing called VoucherCloud. So is now a multi-international, huge, gazillion-pound-selling business.
And that was you that founded that?
Three of us, yeah. Three of us. Four of us started, five of us in a little room in Bedminster, which is very Bristol, you know. Well, that's what I love. Don't you just love that about Bristol, that there are all these incredible, talented kids, people, doing amazing things in little corners of Bristol that go on to become significant. Right time, right place, completely lucky. No great talent on my part, but I was the old greybeard. I'd kind of been round the block a few times and could help these young people develop it. But it then grew out of all control for me. It became a corporate monolith that I kind of just didn't want to be a part of, you know, so I sold out, left.
What do you think it is about Bristol that creates that environment for an independent, do-it-yourself mindset?
Bristol, back in the day when I came in the 80s, I'd never heard of Bristol. I knew there was a bridge, I think, and maybe a mad polar bear in the zoo. That was about as much as my knowledge of Bristol was. But it was very backward, Bristol. It was quite a sleepy old, but you could tell there was this whole attitude, both from obviously prevalent with the Bristolians themselves and then newcomers, interlopers like me who turned up, came along. And there was a definite attitude. around being independent. It was funny, at venue, you would see huge restaurant chains arrive and open up a place, and I could tell them, well, I didn't tell them, but I knew within minutes that it would go bust, just because their whole attitude is, we're the kiddies, we're from London, you country bumpkins will be begging for this brand. They had a thing called Radio West back in the day, which became GWR eventually, but it started out as this, again, national thing brought down. They brought down a load of kind of named DJs, Johnny Walker, David Lee Trapp, all sorts of weird and wonderful people who didn't know where Bidminster was, didn't know where Eastern was, had no, and they were just condescending. So Bristol has always been fiercely independent, and I think as it grows, then it attracts people who love that, and then those people tend to be interesting people, and it just, so it feeds on itself as attracting to the city and generating a whole level of talent. You know, Ronnie Size, all the people from Bristol, just people who, Delge, Massive Attack, just so many people that are Bristol-based. It's not like it's all in people that have come to the city. I don't know. It's just got a creative vibe, like Brighton, I guess, or...
Something in the water.
Yeah. What's your view on it?
I feel like it tries to keep its independence and character and integrity away from London, because London gets so much of, you know, the money and investment and global recognition, and I just think Bristol, being not too far away, we're sort of like its sibling in a way. We're going to be like, we're going to do our own thing, that's it, like, yeah, we don't need you, we're going to make our own way in the world. And, you know, to a certain extent, we do. It's very, very rare you find a Bristolian that's like not happy with where they're from or the city they grew up in. And I think that speaks volumes, because...
Absolutely. My daughter was born here, yeah, you know, and just brought up here, which for me is, I was itinerant. I mean, although I've been here 40 years, I don't feel I'm from Bristol. Mm. And she is so proud. She's in Manchester now and talks about Bristol. But everyone in Manchester goes, wow, you're from Bristol.
Yeah.
Wow, what a city.
I've gone around the world and people say that and they know about Bristol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that really makes you proud, you know. You suddenly think, wow, okay, that's true.
Yeah. It feels like a distinct city in the south, whereas only maybe, Bristol, London, Brighton has that. Whereas the others sort of are like folded into Devon or Cornwall or Wiltshire, but Bristol seems to be its own thing.
Yeah, I'm sure every city would claim. I mean, she's at Manchester, like I say, and I suddenly started discovering Manchester, and there's just a vibe there that I love, absolutely love, you know. So every city would see itself as independent and creative, but actually a lot of people view Bristol as right up there. And I think it's also about collaboration. There are just so many talented people that find each other within Bristol and within their genres or niche areas of interest.
Mm. Not that competitiveness, whereas maybe that's in London.
Absolutely. In London, it's about dog eat dog. You have to get on, be better than someone else, take their job, move above that person, prove yourself better than that person. In Bristol, it's about collaboration.
I don't think we take ourselves too seriously either.
No. Great point.
Because, you know, good point. You go out in London, everyone's like being too cool and not dancing and etc. Yeah. Whereas in Bristol, we've got our hoodie on and we're just raving.
And they take the piss out.
Don't care. That,
you know, they just don't like people who are up themselves, you know.
Mm-hmm. And to end, Dougal, how do you see the future of local media in Bristol?
Again, very interesting. I think it will thrive. I think the smaller community-based media projects will only get bigger and better in terms of their reach and their status and standing, and they will take on the nationals for sure. I'm worried it might fragment a bit, you know. One of the great things that came out of Venue, for example, that I kind of co-founded, but as a community interest thing, was Bristol 24/7. And that's kind of covering a lot of bases. But that is thriving and growing and growing and doing amazing stuff, similar to Venue in the sense that they cover what they cover, but actually they're working with kids from disadvantaged backgrounds. They're doing all kinds of interesting community projects. And it's really being supported by the Bristol community. So that gives me hope that worthwhile ventures that have got integrity and principles and are based on real kind of belief systems rather than making money, quick money, will thrive.
Dougal Templeton, thank you very much.
Hey, great talking to you.